BIAG World is brought to you by headscape.co.uk and shopify.com, a designer-friendly e-commerce solution. For information, go to shopify.com/BIAG World. On this week's show, we're live from South by Southwest in Austin. Show features Andy Budd, Jeremy Keith, Daniel Berker, Joe Stump, Paul BIAG, and just about two words from me.
Hi Paul, how are you doing?
Hi Paul, how are you?
Hello Paul.
Hi Paul.
Hi Paul and Marcus.
Hello and welcome to the first ever BIAGworld.com podcast.
BIAG World!
Hello and welcome to the 100th episode of BIAG World! Episode of BIAGworld.com, the podcast for all those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. My name is Paul BIAG and thank you all for coming. Okay, so what we, how this all came about, I guess, is basically we thought, as we're going to be in South by Southwest, we don't want to prepare a proper show because that's far too much like hard work. So what we thought instead is we would get together and we would do a little live show and we would grab some very clever and intelligent people and we would get them in and we would just answer a load of questions. So the whole of this is going to be a question and answer time. Now we're streaming via Ustream too, so we're hoping to get some questions from the chat room there. But you're actually in the room, so we're going to require you to actually get off of your ass, go up to the microphone and ask questions. We've got some questions that have already been emailed in. But before we all do all of that, we need to start by introducing our illustrious, beautiful, attractive panel of guests. And they include Mr. Andy Budd. Hello, Mr. Andy Budd.
Hey, everyone.
Because he's not very well known, I better introduce him. He's the author of CSS Mastery, and his website is andybudd.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Andy Budd. Next to him, we have, well, the world famous, quite frankly, Jeremy Keith.
Yeah. Hello.
Author of Dom Scripting. You can check him out at adaccio.com and follow him on Twitter at adaccio, even though he doesn't follow me.
You retweet.
I retweet. The ultimate crime. Kill me now. Okay, next up we have Daniel Berker, ladies and gentlemen.
Handsome Dan. Handsome Dan.
Handsome Dan? I thought that was Dan Rubin.
Oh, they're both handsome.
Interchangeable.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Daniel Berker is the creative director at DIG, and his website is Delta Tango Bravo, and you can follow him on Twitter at dberker. And finally, but no means least, notice I'm not including Marcus in this lineup. He doesn't count.
What?
We have Joe Stump, the lead architect at DIG. You can find out about Joe at joestump.net or follow him at joestump. So there we go. And we have a very British show tonight and it's all going to be super... Why are you taking the mic away from me?
Because you didn't introduce me.
Go on then. Introduce yourself.
No, you have to do it.
Okay. So finally on our lineup is Marcus Lillington, an ageing pop star with no real talent.
Who said that?
Okay. Well, guess. It's one of two, isn't it? It's either Bud or Keith, one or the other. Okay, so what we're going to do...
I'll be interrupting everyone, because I've got lots of questions coming up here from the stream, and I'm taking Andy's tip.
My tips,
that I should interrupt people as often as possible when on a panel.
If they're boring, I think was the caveat, wasn't it?
I don't think it was, actually.
Is it just interrupt all the time?
If they're going on too long.
This was all just out of Jeremy Keith's excellent facilitation in the At Media conference, where basically he did the Simon Cowell approach of just being really rude and nasty to everyone, and it was hilarious.
That's what people want. You want a bit of snarkiness, a bit of nastiness. Wow. You know, as well.
Okay. Well, we'll ignore them. I don't think... We don't show our panel respect. I think that would be a mistake, actually listening to their opinion. So what we will do instead is move on to some questions. Now, I think probably the place to start, to give you time to settle in...
Sorry, first question, why is Paul shouting?
Arse.
Who was that? Can we ban them? Is there a way of banning people from the chat room? No. Okay. So, yes, first question. To give you time to settle in and to kind of work out the level of question that we're talking about here, because we do expect quite a high level of questions from our audience, because obviously it's a very high caliber of audience. So our first question, which was sent in advance, is if you were a web application, which web application would you be and why? So I think, who wants to start off with that, the answer to that question?
I'd be everybodylovestrammel.com or emergencytrammel.com.
Oh yeah.
What's this?
Can you bring up sites while we're talking?
No.
Emergency Trammel, TRAMMELL, is every time you need Mark Trammel, you just summon him and he will cackle for you.
Okay. So why do you feel that that's the appropriate website for you?
Oh, shoot. Now I actually have to explain it?
Well, I'm expecting too much from you, obviously. You could just leave it there if you've no justification. That's perfectly valid.
I put the happy mode on everything.
You put
so
the
if
happy.
Something is stressful, I would prefer to laugh at it.
Oh,
and
okay.
Emergency Trammel is the perfect fit for that.
Okay, I see where you're coming from. That's absolutely fine. What about you, Andy? Which website would you go for? Why are you shaking your head? It's a perfectly legitimate question.
It's completely
by one of our listeners.
Ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
This just shows the level of your audience.
Great thing to do.
Wow.
Insult the audience.
Present company accepted. Like you're. Okay. Well.
Just choose one.
Okay. Well, we got one Andy's answer then, because obviously he just disapproves of the question. I'm sure Jeremy's got a good answer.
I don't. Now, this feels like blind date or something. You know. Kind of web. Well, I'd be a really sexy web. I'd lick you all over. The question is kind of meaningless unless it's rephrased as what web apps do you like?
So,
in which
so,
case, that's
so is this the way it's going to go? Basically, you're just going to refuse to answer any of the questions.
Illogical ones, yes. We demand inherently sort of logical structures to the questions.
Okay.
I'm Last FM.
Joe, do you wish to also boycott this question?
I actually had what I thought was a pretty good one. I'd be Google because I'd know everything about everyone.
Oh.
I apologize for the serious answer.
Okay. Right, so feel free, any point, walk up to the mic and go for it. I know it's very intimidating. Just to make it slightly more intimidating for you, if you're American, we require an English accent. So come up to the mic. It can be Mockney. That's fine. If you can do the bad Cockney accent, think of Mary Poppins, maybe. That kind of. Oh, we got a question already.
Go. Right then. So I was wondering. Jeremy Keith is a big fan of hand coding JavaScript, but I've also heard that you use jQuery and so forth to prototype things. And also, I was wondering what your opinions are of CSS frameworks.
CSS.
Good effort.
That's the best I could do.
That was the best South African accent ever.
That was an Australian accent.
Okay.
That was Australian. Touch of New Zealand in there. A bit of everything, really.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, now we have serious questions, I guess. Hand coding JavaScript. Yes, to a certain extent, I do believe that you need to understand what you're doing under the hood, or at least have a knowledge of what's going on under the hood before you use a tool, right? Instead of using a library like a black box where you don't know what's going on. That said, you know, the deadline is looming on Friday, you got to get something done. And if something's been as widely tested as jQuery, Scriptaculous, all these libraries, then, yeah, JavaScript's kind of a case where it takes a lot of the nastiness out of it, right? Because there's things like event handlers and trying to do effects and trying to, do all the stuff that should be easy and isn't, it helps you. Now, CSS frameworks, on the other hand, this is slightly different. So here's the thing. With a good JavaScript library, you've already got your semantic structure in place with your markup, and then you do stuff to that using JavaScript. So the jQuery philosophy, for example, find stuff, do stuff to it. In order to find stuff using, selectors, you have to already have a good document written. So the library serves the HTML. It is subservient to the HTML. CSS frameworks, libraries, toolkits, call them what you will, for the most part, they're subservient to the HTML when they're supplying CSS declarations for elements, CSS declarations for attributes, right? So here's how we'll style all the H1s, we'll style all the paragraphs this way. That's all fine. That's no problem. As soon as a CSS library dictates which classes or IDs you should be using in your markup, that is well wrong. That is like well out of order. Because now you've got the CSS.
I'm done encouraging.
Oh man, I haven't even started. Now you've got the HTML is now being subservient to the CSS, which is completely the wrong way around. You use CSS to style an existing HTML document. You decide on the semantics of that document according to what are the best semantics available. Now that means what are the best elements to choose, and then when you're extending the semantics using class and IDs, you choose what are the best, most semantic class names or IDs to use. If a library is dictating that you must now use the class, you know, call 5 row 7, then it's all backwards, and the tail is wagging the dog. So I have nothing against CSS frameworks that help you with, you know, your typography, your white space, all that stuff, as long as what they do is they style elements and attributes, pseudo selectors, fine. As soon as a CSS framework dictates my classes and my IDs, I say no.
So does that also apply when you're prototyping?
Not at all, because none of that's ever meant for public consumption.
Okay.
With prototyping, cool. You just get it out there as quick as you can. It doesn't matter how shitty the markup is.
Did you ever prototype anything in such a sophisticated way that you'd need a CSS framework anyway? Like, I can't imagine.
No, just to save time. Just to save time. That you're like, oh, you know, we're going to mock it together quickly. Let's use, you know, Blueprint or something like that, and we get it together in, you know, 10 minutes rather than an hour or whatever.
But we do tend to prototype at quite a high level. I mean, I think James and Rich did a session last year at South by Southwest on CSS prototyping. And we find, I mean, a lot of user experience people are afraid to code and they don't know how to code. You know, a lot of people come from a HCI background. And so they rely on either pen and paper, which is really useful, or they jump into kind of prototyping tools like Axure. And you tend to find that they're kind of divorced from actually what's going on and what's possible. We like to kind of ditch the tools. There's no need to have a new prototyping tool, a GUI that you kind of drag and drop form elements on, because you've got code, you've got HTML and CSS. So we actually do create quite high fidelity prototypes. We've got a jQuery plugin, which a company of ours, friends of ours helped develop, called Polypage, which allows state sort of management. And it's really quite...
Yeah, I will say that works for us, because, you know, everyone at the company is pretty, you know, HTML literate. Clearly, that's not going to work for everyone, so other people
right.
know.
But like even Silver Orange or, you know, at Dig, like, we can all write sophisticated code, but, you know, generally, you know, the prototyping, I keep it really dead simple, and then, you know, test it really quickly and get into the real thing.
I think it depends on a lot of things. It depends on who your audience is. It depends on the budget. It depends at what stage of the project. Normally, I know we're going wildly off topic here, but normally we'll prototype.
That's good, by the way, Andy.
Oh, thanks.
Nice bit of interruption there, Marcus.
We prototype really quickly on paper.
Right.
And then if it warrants, because you can't really indicate sort of. A lot of this advanced sort of JavaScript-y, Ajax-y functionality on paper. You know, you can have little things that say slide, whatever. But actually manifesting it, actually showing it to the developers who are going to be implementing it, showing it to the clients, they get this sense, this tangible sense of how this site is going to work is really useful. I know a lot of people that are UX people for in-house organizations. And what happens is they spec this stuff out on paper, like it's going to have this behavior. They give it to the developers. The developers go, actually, that's going to take too long to implement. We're not going to bother. The product owner hasn't experienced that thing in person directly. So they go, okay, well, we haven't seen how this piece of Ajax is going to work, so let's ditch it. So actually showing these experiences, I mean, we're experienced designers, so making the experience tangible and jump off the page is good.
Right, I guess I've got maybe the advantage of working with the same developers all the time, and we both are on a similar wavelength and can kind of,
I think,
you know,
Paul's getting bored.
Together.
No, I was liking it because I don't have to do anything. Carry on.
Well, we're done now. You've got to do something.
You are in a good situation. And I'm in a way, I'm quite jealous of people who are working at the same place. And you and Joe, you get to iterate on stuff all the time, right? You put it out there and find out how it's working, and you work on it some more. Whereas we tend to do the client work, which tends to be, you know, a fixed time or fixed budget, and then we're done with the work. It's really frustrating sometimes, because once the site's out there, like, oh, give us, you know, hire us again to like work on that bit some more. And the fact that we can, you know, it's like kind of frustrating. Yeah. So in some ways, I'm envious of you guys having the same project. On the other hand, I'd go crazy if I was working on the same thing all the time.
I do go crazy.
You do?
Yeah. But one of the I've got, you know, experience in both worlds, right, from Silver Orange and. I guess they've got the advantage too that they've got a business model that's surrounded around having long-term relationships with clients. So they do, a lot of work on commission, which is really, I think, an interesting business model on the web. And so we've got 6-7 year relationships with some of our clients now, which, you've got more than one project going on at the time, but each project is over a long period of time. So you get that.
Okay, that's enough. I'm bored now.
Wait, I want to know if anyone disagrees with me about the CSS frameworks.
Does anybody like CSS frameworks?
Oh, shut up.
Paul?
Look.
Oh, somebody put their hand up.
There are people queuing up. Desperate.
I forgot there were people. On and on and on.
You know, I know I picked you guys because you can talk, but for goodness sake.
So why don't I pick a question?
Dustin, let's hear your English accent. Go for it.
I'm starting to feel a little invisible up here. Now actually what I'm going to say is like almost slightly off topic because it was like something we were talking about 5 minutes ago.
But, that's fine.
You can blame me.
So I'm Facebook. A web developer. What's that?
I'm Facebook.
You're on Facebook?
No, he is. I'm Facebook. I thought you were going to ask about which app we were.
All right.
Don't let the nasty man put you off.
By the way, I'm not going to talk.
I want to see Dustin finish
accent.
A sentence. Come on.
You can do it. Will you guys shut up long enough for him to say, ask his question? Shush.
I just want to say something about Dustin. No, sorry. Do a search for Cameron Diaz nude.
Topless.
So Cameron Diaz topless. Dustin in a picture of Dustin in the Iron Cactus from 2007. 2000 is the top result in Google.
There's Cameron Adams and Dustin Diaz with their shirts off in the Iron Cactus with the title
Seriously?
Cameron Diaz topless.
The poor man ask his question now?
Is there a point to this?
Dustin, please carry on. We value your opinion.
I am a full-time web developer on Gmail as a prototyper, and since someone has to disagree with Jeremy on this, that I'm actually a proponent of CSS frameworks where it sort of does dictate how you write HTML. And I agree that it is... Yeah, one person agrees. So, yeah, in one sense, I mean, go figure, Google engineers don't know how to write good HTML and CSS. And so this sort of helps them.
I would have never known that.
I've got two words for you, Dustin. Dustin, view source. I've seen Google's markup.
Yeah, it sucks. I agree.
I rest my case.
I teach engineers how to write good HTML and CSS on a pretty much daily basis. And we teach courses on how to write semantic markup. And it's no figure. You can view source on any given Google app, and it's not the most wonderful thing in the world. But you have, nuclear scientists that know how to do many other awesome regular expressions, and they can come up with really awesome algorithms and whatnot, which I'm not going to even continue to think about. But I think there is a great thing about CSS frameworks that helps engineers get their work done a lot faster, and it's not necessarily semantic, but it's a lot lighter weight, and it helps reduce latency and things like that. So I don't want to say that they're necessarily like a bad thing.
Can I sort of jump in on that? Because I think you're right. I think the problem is that there's a problem with the term CSS frameworks.
Yes.
I think that these pre-written things like Blueprint, which have a real tight tie to the markup, use non-semantic, table-style sort of markup, are really, really bad. But there's nothing to stop you from creating your own internal framework or templating language. You guys are the front-end developers. You shouldn't immediately reach for a pre-built system that someone else has built. What you do is you look at all of the requirements of your app, look at all of the widgets that are required, the different layout styles, the different column widths, and create your own internal framework. And that is then something you will go and you will explain to your developers.
Yep. Yeah, I think
this is something that we've done at Dig, is that, like, in our code base, we've created a bunch of domain-specific frameworks. And on top of it, I would argue that a nuclear scientist, even though he's really awesome at writing a lot of really interesting things, shouldn't be allowed anywhere near your HTML markup. We have a couple PhDs on staff, and when Anton Cass first came on, his last job, I think, was doing weird photo algorithms, I think. And he was like, well, I can let me check out the code and I'll start editing it. I'm like, no, just expose it via an HTTP service, and, Daniel and his gurus will take care of it, and then he'll hand it over to my front-end gurus, and then they'll make it go you know, whiz and bang and pop and whatnot.
But at the same time, Google doesn't have. Google's a lot bigger than Dig in one sense, where you have like 10,000 engineers and maybe about 15 web developers. So I think we're in a little bit different situations.
Whose fault is that?
Don't turn it around on me.
Go on, sit down. Go on, go
your act together, you bunch of amateurs.
Enough of that. Let's have our next question.
I was actually going to bring up. I think Joe was just reminding me, like, the one way you could have better markup is just not to fuck with the good markup you're given. It was really funny. I worked on the Firefox start page, you know, the page has a Google search in the middle of it. I spent, like, 3 days marking that up, and, like, I designed it, and I marked it up in this, like, beautiful, simple semantic HTML. I was like, well, this is only ever going to be seen in Firefox, so they don't need to, you know, use the dumbed-down, lowest common denominator code. They launched it, and I looked at the source, and they had, like, ripped it to fuck, and it's like, 30 tables. I'm so mad.
Yeah, nukes out of HTML. Yeah.
Okay, next question.
Let me start off by saying that naked.dustindiaz.com is like the top refer to my site, so thank you.
Oh, no, don't start sucking up to the previous questioner.
So I work at a large company, and I push Agile for our development, you know, projects. I love it. But I work on a side project. I have a side project that I call Standard Pixel, where I kind of do, you know, small projects for, you know, nonprofits and stuff like that. I don't make money on it. But I haven't found a good way to use Agile in those small kind of, you know, couple-person projects, that kind of stuff. Do you guys have any experience with that? You know, any good pointers for that?
I've been working on a side project recently, and we're literally doing one-hour sprints. Yeah, I think you can do it. The one thing that we've done is that we break everything out into, because you're working on much smaller projects. You're probably working on projects that total are 20, 30 hours, maybe right around there. So
it's not ongoing like, you know, some of the huge, you know, web apps that I work on regularly. You know?
Yeah, exactly. So what we've done for our side project is we've broken things down into 1 hour sprints. We try to break the tasks down into 15, 20, maybe 30-minute tasks, and we commit after each task, and then we roll up a sprint after each hour and roll a build. We're doing iPhone apps.
What's the point? I don't get it. Like, Silver Orange, who I previously worked, really small group, and, like, we've ostensibly were working in, you know, almost an agile way just naturally, because that's the way really small groups work, right? And, you know, we, of course, use a bug tracker, that kind of thing, to follow stuff, but, like, if you're doing a sprint that's only 20 minutes, a bug that's only 20 minutes and a sprint that's only an hour, like, don't you spend more time overseeing that than actually doing it?
No, it helps keep you focused. I mean, we come up with a task list ahead of time, so you can spec out 20, 30 hours of work in about an hour, and you have a clear roadmap of where you're going to go, and you have breakpoints to where you should be at the end of each, and they don't have to be as small as an hour. The reason we did that is because we were in complete crunch time at the time.
Just out of interest, how many developers, how many people working on this project?
There's 2 iPhone developers, 3 designers, and 2 web guys.
Okay. Because, I mean, imagining if there's only 1 or 2 of you, it seems like sort of overkill to use an agile project for a 30-hour thing. I mean, if there's 5 or 6 of you and you're already used to working in an agile fashion, what you're doing is you're taking an existing project management methodology and just scaling it down, but still you're using it because there's 6 or 7 people to manage. If there's just 1 or 2 of you, can't you just sort of manage that yourself?
I guess I'm trying to find kind of that same heartbeat, that same kind of, you know, this pulse that you get in an agile project. The problem is that we don't have this long backlog of things that we want, so you don't have all of that inventory to start pulling from. You know, so with these smaller projects, I learn I can't get that kind of flow, and I lose my place. You know?
I think one of the things that I've noticed with agile is it's not so much about managing it; it's about building a cadence in your development process. You get into a cadence where you're breaking off chunks in 1 week. You plow through those. It keeps you focused. Like we've had problems at Dig where, you know, like Daniel and Kevin come up with the latest and greatest idea, and I look at it, I'm like, Jesus, that's a 6-month project. And for developers, that becomes very daunting to build that over 6 months, because you get into that 4th month and you're like, when am I going to be able to work on something else? You get bored.
But so how does that apply to a 30-hour project?
Well, I still think that it depends on how.
Just a lot of 30-hour projects equal a 6-month project?
Well, if you're doing a lot of, not only that, like 30 hours still, if you're doing it over a weekend, that's 2 15-hour days. I lose track of, you know, what way is up after about 13 hours of coding. So
I find there's this weird religious kind of fervor around agile or any kind of project sort of planning sort of methodology. I think, you know, you need to use the right tool for the job, and if the right tool for the job is agile, then use agile. If it's iterative design, then use iterative design. If it's waterfall, use waterfall. I mean, I see a lot of people saying that waterfall is just, you know, bad full stop. But for projects that are short and very, very design-led, I think it makes a certain amount more sense than using Agile, which I actually think is much more suited to sort of development-led projects. And I'd say in a 30-hour project, it kind of, I mean, it doesn't, you know, I mean, I think it's just all about personal interest as well and the ability of your team. And, you know, if you guys have got a team and you've all worked on Agile projects before, maybe it's right for you, but I know it wouldn't be right for us.
Okay.
I don't think. Well, I know. Would you?
I don't understand all this Agile. Okay. So I never have. Apparently, we do Agile. I've never really paid any attention to it.
We've got so many questions. I think we need to keep moving it on. Can we have the next question, please?
Hi, guys. Just touching back on the prototyping a wireframe topic, I was wondering what the panel thinks of tools like Balsamiq for doing the wireframing.
Any tool that has Comic Sans as its typeface.
That's
slick.
Then, following on from that, I was wondering how you go about explaining to clients what the wireframes are, because we get a problem so often where the clients don't understand that the wireframes aren't the finished website.
That's a good point. That's a good point. And there it depends on the client. Yeah. And if we you know, you check out the client first. It's not the first time you meet the client isn't when you're presenting wireframes, right? You've already met them, you got to know them, and you get a feeling for how web savvy they are. Right, and you decide based on that really what kind of tools you're going to use, and you see something. I'm not going to show this guy HTML wireframes because he's going to think I'm showing him the website, and he's like, well, I don't like all the gray, you know. And it's like, no. Then there, a different tool is probably going to be better suited, like paper or something, PDFs.
I mean, that partly comes down to presentation, right? I mean, if you make it look kind of like the website's going to look, they'll immediately jump to conclusions, right? And so, you know, slapping, you know, big draft on it, you know, even on the side or something, and, you know,
what about the under construction guy?
Yeah, it's absolutely underutilized is the under construction dude, but
animated,
yeah.
Oh, sweet.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's,
yeah, but I'm not really kidding. I mean, if you make the site not, you know, if it still looks like a prototype, you know, they won't draw too many conclusions from it. So
I get a lot of people asking me this all the time, actually, and I find it really strange because we've never, or maybe once, had a client that's come to us and said that they've got confused the difference between a prototype and a wireframe. Or the actual website.
We get them.
Yeah. We have, recently.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I think I remember you. Anyway.
But you guys aren't that good, so.
But I think, you know, I think
that's why you brought the panelists on, right?
But I think in the initial engagement, you need to explain what you're doing, explain your process. And I think if you do a good job, you won't have these issues.
This panel's improving since Paul left the stage.
But the other thing is, I think there's an important thing to be said, which is a lot of people see wireframes as a deliverable. And I don't know why people have to feel that they're deliverables. Like, I use wireframes, and we use wireframes partly as a... just for the purpose of the podcast, Paul is being an idiot.
Some things never change, eh?
Did you have a question, Paul?
Sure it wasn't relevant if you did.
Should we hug this out?
So why does it have to be a deliverable? I mean, a lot of the time you use wireframes to inform your own decision-making process. You know, you sketch things out, you screw them up, you throw them away. We have this weird mentality that every piece of design artifact that we create, we have to get some kind of official sign-off. We can't go to the next stage for fear that the client or the person paying our bills is, you know, he's got to approve these sketch wireframes. So we also need to know when it's appropriate to use this thing as a deliverable, when it's appropriate to use it as a discussion point, and when it's appropriate just to use it as a method of thinking out the problem.
Okay, I want to move on, but sorry, I'm just going to have to use some of the questions people have sent in as well, otherwise I'll get in so much trouble, but we'll do your question in a minute. Just to kind of set the tone again, I feel that maybe we're getting a little bit serious, so I want to ask the panel, what's the biggest fuck-up you've ever made?
Coming on this panel?
This is getting mean.
I mean, you know, actually in your web design career then, which is obviously this is the end of.
I want to know who's used the blink tag. That's got to be rank up there as the biggest fuck up. I'll go ahead and start this one off because I think I'm probably the only one that regularly brings down sites. I have one myself, and then I have one that Cal Henderson from Flickr told at another panel I was on that was pretty epic. So early on in my career, I was lucky enough to get a job when I was about 18 working at a local computer company. And I had rewritten their entire e-commerce website. They had one server that ran their entire POS system, which actually is point-of-sale system. So I had every single sale that had ever been entered into their system on it, along with their entire website and all of the website's database, et cetera. All of the email ran from this website, or this web server, et cetera. I don't know, I was, you know, I was on the command line moving around as root. You can tell where this is going. And I accidentally typed, and I'm not joking, rm-fr/*, on a production website, web server, as it was running. And the only saving grace is that evidently RM deletes in alphabetical order. So everything was in user and www, and I was able to hit control C before it got there, but not before it hit /dev. And my boss at the time, he still does not know this to this day. We're still friends. He comes in. We probably won't be after he sees this. He comes in and he's, you know, freaking out. The website has been hacked. It's been hacked. What's going on? I'm like, yeah, it's been hacked. Totally, yeah. So to this day, Keith does not know that the website was in fact not hacked. And then Cal brought down Flickr in the early days, but he ran out of disk space. He wasn't running DU and didn't have monitoring set up and ran out of hard drive space.
There we go. Anybody else got?
I can't top that. I cannot top that. But I do want... Well, I did something... I still don't consider this a fuck-up on my part, but other people... other people consider this out of order. So I wrote this PHP script to celebrate Talk Like a Pirate Day, September 19th, right? Now, some of you heard this story before. So, it takes a... You give it a URL, and it then takes the content of the URL and inserts random pirate phrases, right? Arr, me hearties, shiver me timbers, right? All that kind of stuff. That's fine. So you kind of piratify the web page. Okay, pretty straightforward little spoof thing to do. But then what I also did was I also found all the hrefs in that page and just rewrote them that instead of pointing to wherever they were pointing, they now pointed to the same pirate generator version, right? So all the links now point to a pirated version of the next page, right?
Right, yeah.
Well, Google found this. And Google indexed this. And essentially, Google created a one-to-one copy of the World Wide Web in pirate speak. And so because my site would have better Google ranking than some of the sites that were being, you know, run through this piratifier thing, the pirated version would come up higher in Google rankings than the original version. And I started getting emails and stuff from people all over the world. I mean, there was no connection amongst all these people from everywhere, saying, like, why are you hacking my website? I demand you remove the files from your server. I'm like, I'm not storing any files on my server. I'm not doing it. And finally, I took it offline. I think it was a phone call. Yeah, it was a phone call from a spinal surgery clinic in Florida saying, could I please do something? Because the customers were getting scared away when they were saying, like, you know, come to us for the best in surgery, me hearties.
That's pretty good, I've got to say.
But I don't consider it a fuck-up, you know.
Of course, it's a feature. We'll take another question for the floor, and I'll come back to this.
All right,
later.
Thank you, guys. My question is, I'm not a developer nor programmer. I'm just an entrepreneur, and we want to develop a web app as a business. What is the best advice or steps that you should, you know, you will give us before going out there and hiring somebody? Because we made so many mistakes in the past doing any kind of web, so we want to. This is something new for us, and we want to know any advice that you can give us that's okay. Worthwhile.
So I've recently gone through this where normally I'm the guy developing everything, but then I had to go out and find iPhone developers, and iPhone developers are really expensive right now, like really expensive. Crappy iPhone developers are 150 bones an hour. So what I did is I went out and found a really good iPhone developer and had him review people that were a lot cheaper, their code. And I do this with web people as well, and I do this with designers as well. I go and find there's a lot of young kids out there that are exceptionally talented, really, really smart kids that are just looking to get in the door and do something interesting and fun.
But you find them on like Elance sites like that? Or
no, that is pretty much the last place you'll find anybody with a couple brain cells. I would the way that I've been finding them is through Twitter and whatnot. You know, I'm kind of lucky. I've got a couple thousand followers, and they all happen to be nerds. So I can tweet out and be like, hey, I'm looking for somebody to help me with Django, and pretty quickly I get that. But I would go and look at Django Project, for instance. They have a bunch of, they have an entire website devoted to people that work on Django. Ruby does as well. PHP does as well. And I would find people that are in your time zone, but maybe work in cheaper countries that, you know, are good. And then I would find people that are really, really good and go ahead and pay them $500 to review their code. But then when the app actually needs to be written, go find somebody that's working for 25, 30, 40 bucks an hour.
Cool.
Thanks.
Anybody else? Well, I don't really have any advice when it comes to building the web app side of things because, you know, we're more of an agency background. But when we're hiring people at ClearLeft, what we're looking for is enthusiasm, not necessarily that they have the skill right now, but that they clearly are willing to learn. So if someone's got a blog, that counts for so much more than if they got a college degree, right?
Sure.
The enthusiasm, really. That's what we're looking for.
Good stuff. Okay, next question.
Hi. I really like the Django template language. What template languages do you like? And second, Paul, what happened at the Grande Rio today?
Pardon me? Oh, yes. No, just slow service. Nothing to dwell on. So has anybody got... moving on.
What is this? Is there something we should know? What's this?
No. It's okay. It's just, just a throwaway tweet. Don't pick me up on it. Leave me alone.
Are you interested in frameworks as a designer or as a developer?
Either.
I hadn't really used frameworks that much until we did Pounce, and that we did that in Django. I've got to say, like, it was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
As a templating language for designers, the documentation is extremely clear and well-written for designers, and some of the basic tools that are available for designers are totally awesome. I'm used to working in raw PHP, you know, really untemplated stuff, and it was liberating to work in Django. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, we use at Dig, we use Smarty, but which gets ragged on a lot in the PHP community because PHP developers think that PHP is a templating language. I think we've kind of grown past that at this point. There's a new Smarty, there's a one that looks like Smarty and kind of behaves like Smarty, and I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. I want to say it's Dwoo, D-W-O. Django's template engine is amazing. That is one hell of a rabbit hole they've built. I've been using that on my side project and absolutely love Django. So I can't speak to the other ones that are out there.
Cool. Next question.
Okay. If you guys were a programming language, what would you be? No, I'm kidding.
HyperCard.
I was thinking Logo. So I remember in a podcast, I think it was probably...
Oh, no, I hate it when people start quoting back on stuff that I've said.
Well, it was a great podcast where Paul...
Oh, was it the Risington podcast? That's a great podcast.
That was the one where I learned all about cheese. there was a... where you guys talked about things you needed to do to weather the coming economic storm, things as developers to protect your job. I think it was in late 2007. You recommended things like learning a programming JavaScript framework like jQuery.
Okay.
Take two. What would you do now that the economy isn't looking like it's going to be in the shitter? It actually is in the shitter.
Right. Write spaghetti code. Don't document and write spaghetti code. That's the easiest way to keep your job.
Write code that no one else can ever understand.
Don't use line breaks.
Has anybody got any sensible suggestions?
Well, I would just say, you know, now's the time to make some cool shit. I remember, you know, in the first sort of dot-com bust, I was like, oh, everything's terrible, everything's crashing. And some of the coolest stuff came out of that from people who had time on their hands now. They're sitting on a sofa and they started making cool shit, you know. This is when we got Blogger and this is when we got Flickr and we got all these great sites. It came out of that opportunity. Yeah. And now if it looks like, you know, people are going to lose their jobs and have time, great. Now you got time to build something awesome. So my advice is build something awesome.
I had a friend that came up to me, and he's in recruiting, in technical recruiting, which, as one might expect, has slowed down considerably in the last year. And he was considering not building cool shit, but I think he had a really good point. He's thinking about traveling the world for a year. And he said that right now the opportunity cost has never been lower to do that. And that's how I feel about starting new companies and starting new projects. The opportunity cost has never been lower because, fuck, you have no job or you're only making $20 an hour, right? I mean, your opportunity cost is basically zero at this point. So absolutely get out there. And I'm using, my side projects to learn Python and Django and kind of expand my horizons. And I'm expanding into iPhones. This is very new territory for me as well.
Even if you don't build the next greatest thing, when I look at portfolios of, designers who apply to Dig, the primary thing I'm looking for is recent work that's good. Yeah. And if, I always love the 37 Signals Better projects that they did. Early on in 37 Signals, they did these, before they, I think they were still, kind of building their client base and stuff. And they did a bunch of side projects where they were like, well, if I redesigned a banking website, this is what I'd do. And they built the optimal interface for a banking interface. It was awesome. I've seen a few portfolios that come in and people have done these fictional design projects. They may not, they may just be, experimenting, expanding their mind, with these projects. And they're awesome. I get a view of how they think and how they work. And they're much more likely to get a job.
I agree with that. I look for tinkerers when I'm hiring people. Like, if, for instance, I had someone come in for an interview a while ago, and they'd never. So, for those of you that don't know what PHP is, bear with me. There's this very large library called Pear, and it's an official PHP project. And the guy was like, "Yeah, I have no idea what Pear is." So he wasn't even tinkering within his own skill set, and tinkering outside of your skill set. Going and playing with Ruby, playing with Django. Lo and behold, these Python and Ruby guys have some pretty smart ideas once in a while, and I've been incorporating some ideas into my own projects at Dig, etc. So I think tinkering is really important.
Yeah, it proves two things that everybody wants to see: is one, you're inquisitive, and two, I can see what kind of quality of work you produce. Yeah. It's awesome. I don't know why more young designers don't do that stuff. Yeah.
I think a lot of freelancers also, or a lot of designers, developers have a problem where they want to have the broadest possible skill set, but what happens is they have a very broad but very shallow skill set. You want to, and it's really tempting because there's so much stuff you can learn. You want to learn how to design, you want to learn to do front-end code, there's loads of different back-end languages to do, you want to learn usability, user experience, and suddenly you're spreading yourself really thin. That's fine for a certain level of project. There's a certain level of project whereby you'll pick up the sort of smaller sort of scale, smaller cost projects where you need to be a generalist. But actually, to kind of advance up that ladder and to make yourself indispensable, I think you actually need to specialize. You still need to have that general base, but you need to be the best CSS person in your area, or the best HTMLer, or the best designer, or the best person in Ruby on Rails. You want to kind of put your head above all of the other people around you to be seen to stand out.
I totally agree with that sentiment. I can't write very much JavaScript, for instance.
But I know.
I don't try. Avoid over-specialization as well. I think you were probably hinting at that.
There's this idea of a T-shaped person where you have a very broad base of skills, but you have specialisms in certain areas. Right. And I think that's, as an employer, that's something that is very attractive. Again, I don't want, you should over-specialize.
I'm thinking of information architects, for instance. Yeah. I never understood an information architect who can't write HTML and CSS.
Yeah.
It's just crazy to me.
Yeah. No, I agree. And you need to understand the fundamentals of the web. You need to understand the canvas in which you're working on. So, an information architect that doesn't understand code is as useless as a designer that doesn't really understand how
architecture.
If nothing else, so that they can talk to other people,
exactly.
Right? So that they, the information architects can talk to your developers, your designers can talk to your coders, all that stuff. But I would point out there is another way of kind of riding out the tough economic times, which is cryogenic storage. Just back yourself up for a few years.
Okay, let's do another question that is by far the most popular question we ever get on Boag World, and we seem to get it time and time again, and I'm getting fed up with answering it, so I'm going to have a panel of other people answer this question for me, which is, when can we say goodbye to Internet Explorer 6?
That's a great question. So, actually, this is very timely, if I can take the mic, is we actually just ran a survey on Dig. Mark Trammell is actually currently working on a blog post about this.
And so this is an ongoing debate at Diggs. It's a pain in the ass to support IE6. And so the developers have all been arguing with us, and QA has been arguing this, like, let's just let it go. And Mark and I are both, well, no, we're not going to let it go. We still think it's a big enough piece of our audience. And all the developers are giving the basic argument, like, well, oh my God, you know, if people only knew, they'd upgrade. You know, because IE6 is still an, you know, a decent piece of our audience, like 5% of our audience. And
which, by the way, is less than the iPhone.
Still, we support the iPhone. But we did this survey, and we got an awesome number of responses, which also indicates the how many people are browsing with IE6. We got something like, you know, 500 or 600 responses in a day to this IE6 survey, and almost all of them, you know, we asked, you know, a bunch of, you know, leading questions, and then we asked, you know, basically, why aren't you using a different browser? And most of them, they're at work, you know, and they don't control the IT stuff, and they can't influence the IT stuff very strongly, or they're on an older machine that, you know, they don't think will, you know, work with a more modern browser. They don't have, you know, the majority of them don't have the opportunity to upgrade, and you can't blame them. I think this really terrible tendency among designers to blame the users. And they're like, well, you're just too dumb to use, you know, a better browser. That's such an arrogant attitude, and I hate it.
Yeah.
I mean, support it as long as, you know, a decent enough member of your user base who, you know, based on, well, if I can expand and go on and on, I really like how, like, Yahoo gauges whether or not they support IE6 and, you know, all browsers that they're testing. I was talking to Nate Coakley about this a few years ago, and they not only run it against the percentage of users who are browsing, you know, with different browsers, but they run it against all the Yahoo properties and figure out how much money those people are spending on Yahoo properties. And so they can say, you know, it's 10% of our audience, but they only, you know, are worth 2% of our model, right, or our profit. And so they can make a more, you know, educated decision on that. And we base, you know, some of our decisions on, you know, what Yahoo does. And that's a public, you know, their browser grading is public. And we generally follow what Yahoo does.
Well, what about Clear Left? What do you guys do as far as IE6?
Well, so my first, I want to answer the question, you know, when can we drop support for IE6? My answer to the question is mu. And mu means I reject the premise of the question.
Yeah.
Because the question is being posed as this binary Boolean kind of thing, true, false, support, not support. And I'm fed up with it. I tried to kickstart this discussion in an article I wrote on 24 Ways at Christmas time, right? Which is like, what the hell do you mean by support?
Yeah.
Because your idea of support is different to my idea of support. So somebody said, oh, I've dropped support for IE6. What they mean is that IE6 doesn't get the rounded corners and the shadows. And that's great. And but other people say, oh, we dropped support for IE6. And I mean, they're actively blocking IE6 users from visiting the site. So to ask, you know, when do we stop supporting IE6? Define support. And you know, I think
for us, it would be whether or not we run QA on it.
Okay.
Know? And QA means, you know, we have graded support at Digg, and QA means, you know, IE6 is perfectly functional, and, you know, it may not look the same, but it's fully functional. And then, you know, then you...
Okay, now you're getting into good. Now you're getting into the nuances of it, what it means to support a browser is not, you know, does it have to look the same in every browser? Does it have to behave the same in every browser? No, it does not. Now, obviously, you know, the browsers visiting the most, they're the ones you want to target and make sure they get the best experience, but... it doesn't have to look the same. It doesn't have to behave the same. This idea that support is this binary thing is really, really frustrating. And if you design your sites a certain way, build your sites in a certain way, this whole idea of, you know, progressive enhancement, progressive enrichment, layering on stuff, unobtrusive JavaScript, then, you know, you're not designing for any particular browser at all. You're designing for the web. And if it works in IE6, but it's not great, then that's okay, you know?
But that's avoiding the question a little bit. I mean,
I'm rejecting the premise of the question.
Does the JavaScript work in IE6, for instance? I mean, it's a bitch to make it work.
This
right?
is my point. If you write your sites in the right way, then if the JavaScript doesn't work, that's okay. That you make the functionality work without JavaScript. Yeah, that's so. That should be inherent in your process that you're not defining technical boundaries to your content. In any way, you know, whether it's, you know, you must have CSS, you must have JavaScript, you must have Ajax,
well,
or you
I
must
mean,
have Flash.
You get
right?
to the scale of something like Digg, and, you know, a lot of Digg, you know, some big parts of Digg don't work without JavaScript.
I bet they could be made to work without JavaScript.
They could. It's not worth the ROI, right? Yeah.
Okay, well, then I understand your problem, because you would have to retrofit an existing site.
Correct.
When you're building something from scratch, if you build it with that layered, you know, setup, then if the JavaScript gets pulled off, then it still works. Not in a nice way, it works in a horrible, slow, you know, lots of page refreshes kind of way, but crucially, no one has ever turned away from your content.
And again, like, you know, if the site's not working without JavaScript, then it's not just an IE6 question, it's an accessibility question as well.
But, I mean, as we get into more sophisticated web applications, that decision is getting less and less obvious. Yeah. I mean, requiring JavaScript isn't crazy anymore.
It depends on the level of complexity. But you don't, every time you require anything, you're automatically shutting out a certain percentage.
Absolutely.
As long as you're okay with that, then that's fine.
Okay. So, go on.
Oh, I was just going to say that I was wondering when we could drop support for links 0.1.
I support links, as in anyone can visit my site with a links browser. But it depends how you define support, right? Yes. No, but seriously, like, you can accomplish the tasks you need to accomplish. When I build sites, you can fulfill your objectives using links. You can fill in that shopping cart. You can check out. You can do whatever you need to do. It doesn't look the same, obviously, but yeah,
well,
I
that's the
support.
Beauty.
Again,
the same
argument was made by Google and Google Maps when they first launched. Oh yeah, this is far too complicated to make work, you know, with JavaScript. But they have, you know, they've started work on that to improve it. So yeah. You know, Google Maps is now getting closer to being, you know, to being usable. So yeah, it's a business decision, but. Yeah,
it's not just a business decision, though. It's like partly a business decision, it's partly a moral decision.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's an ethical quantity to it.
Yes.
Okay, here's another random question, really, that maybe doesn't follow on, in fact, doesn't follow on at all from what we've been talking about. But and that's really the issue of the fact that you guys are sitting there and we're sitting here, right? And it's this whole business of, you know, these guys have been very successful in their careers. They've done amazingly well. And so, how does that come about? How do you get to a situation where you've been very successful, your career has developed really well, and, you know, you're getting speaking engagements and writing books and traveling the world and all this kind of stuff? And it comes out of the book Outliers. I don't know whether any of you have read Outliers, which is a fascinating book. And so the question is, do you think it's down to luck and circumstances or your own skill that has led to your current success? If it's luck and circumstances, what happened to get you in the position where you are, where you are? Do you want to comment on this, or is this a different question?
Why is success defined as speaking at conferences?
Very good question.
The very best. The very best web developers I've ever worked with don't even have a blog.
Yeah.
They don't speak at conferences. Most of them don't even want to go to conferences. They just want to develop really cool stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was talking to a friend of mine who's designs like one of the biggest sites on the internet, and he's never spoken at a conference and isn't really interested in it. So that's a great point.
Yeah.
I
mean,
I come here for the free beer and food.
But I mean, it's a certain arrogance, I think, that, you know, you think that your ideas are worth talking to a bigger group about.
Well, I don't think it's arrogance. I think what the reason that I got into talking in the first place, and I hate to get off on a tangent, is that I had a long conversation with Ryan Carson, who runs the Carsonified events like Future Web Apps and stuff, and he was like, "So, what'd you think of the conference?" And I'm like, "I'm going to be totally honest. If I hadn't gotten a free ticket, I would have never come." And that's the reason that I talk, is because I'm scratching my own itch. When I get up and talk about the things that I talk about, it's because I've been to conferences and nobody's talking about them, and I feel that they're relevant. Now, they may not be relevant, but I feel that they are. And
okay. I mean, the whole speaking thing is a little bit of a tangent, and I agree entirely with what Norma said. But, you know, you guys, you know, you've got Clear Left, which has been hugely successful and has worked with some amazing clients and, you know, has got a massive name and reputation. You know, you two are working for Digg, you know, which is a very high-profile, very sought-after job. How did that happen? Is that down to your amazing skill and talent, or is it just pure luck?
Actually, this is kind of hilarious. The way that I started working at Digg, I submitted my resume. That was it.
Wow.
I swear, I submitted my resume, they called me, and what's even better is, like, our wiki has, like, the old interview notes, and I'm marked as a toss-up. I have no idea how I got the job, to be totally honest.
Okay.
But I think if you look at Silver Orange, for instance, right? I mean, this is a company that's based in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, which is in rural Canada. You know, it's a two-hour flight from Toronto, which is the nearest, you know, Montreal is the nearest really big city. It's an hour and a half away by plane. I mean, it's way out there. But and they, we started small. It was like, you know, a bunch of us coming out of high school started this little company together. And I remember we met with Tom Hughes, who's this, we just happened to know this guy who used to be the creative director at IBM. Like, he's done everything. And he said, do good work and good things will probably happen to you. So, I mean, there's definitely an element of luck to that. You know, mm-hmm. some things fell into our laps. And then some things, like Steve Garrity wrote, who's the creative director at Silver Orange, wrote an email to Mozilla explaining why he thought that Firefox, which at the time was called Phoenix, why it was a great piece of software that would never be successful if they didn't improve their design. That caught on with some people at Mozilla, and we ended up doing a bunch of work that got some good name recognition, right? And so, I mean, take opportunities, you know, put your name out there, you know, I hope that good work is still a prerequisite. I think the web's enough of a meritocracy that just, you know, just being aggressive isn't enough. Mm. I think, you know, focusing on doing quality is still terribly important.
I mean, I'm really keen to hear Clear Left's perspective on all this, but unfortunately we're out of time.
How the hell did you guys become good?
So there we go. We're about to run out of time. Sorry, guys. We've got to do the most important part of the show, and I can't possibly not do this part of the show, which is we couldn't end, could we, without a joke from Marcus. It would just be wrong.
Are you sure?
We could. Actually end with
no we have to go on because I want to prove once and for all that your jokes aren't funny. There's a live audience here, none of which are now going to laugh.
That would be good, actually. Complete silence.
Complete.
I have to say, none of these jokes are my jokes.
Oh, shift the response.
That's fair enough though, isn't it? But I picked this one because it seemed like the most appropriate, i.e. it's not very good. You've been a good horse, said the farmer. You're strong and don't spook easily, but you could be faster at pulling the plough. That's my only criticism. The horse looked blankly at the farmer for a moment before replying, no, I said feed bag. Somebody laughed.
Feed back. Oh, right. Is that it?
That's it.
I stopped Jeremy and Andy from answering a question for that.
I wasn't even going to do one.
Guys, would you like to answer our previous question? Carry on from where we got to.
We need another joke.
You've got a joke?
No.
You want another joke from Marcus? Has anybody got a joke? Come up.
Answer.
If you've got a joke, come up and tell a joke. No. So you're happy to criticise him for having a go, and then you won't do it yourself.
Jeremy.
Okay. Oh, Jeremy's got a joke.
You got a joke?
Yeah, if you want. Go for it, Jeremy.
Okay, I can tell my favourite joke, which only me and one other person in the world finds funny.
Is this going to be about microformats?
No. It's not going to be a techie joke. No, actually, I won't. It's too tasteless. I can't tell.
Oh, no. No.
I'll tell the joke.
Afterwards. Once we finish recording, you can tell the joke.
In the bar.
Here we go.
Why did the chicken cross the Mobius strip? To get to the same side.
Yeah.
Womp, womp.
Tough crowd.
Okay, that's quite enough.
Hard up here, Jeremy, isn't it?
It was such a good podcast until the end. Okay, thank you very much. I really want to thank you guys. I'm so grateful for you coming and doing this.
Thank you.
Also, I really want to thank you guys as well, because I recognise that you guys have hung around when there's parties and alcohol out there, and I really appreciate that. So thank you very much, and keep listening. Goodbye.
Thank you.
So there we go. That was our live show from South by Southwest, and a lot of fun it was too. In fact, the whole conference has been massively fun.
And
the sun's out today, which it hasn't been for the last few days. We do, however, want to apologise, don't we?
Yeah, we do. The live feed was a nightmare for many reasons.
Yes.
None of them our fault, obviously.
Well, yes and no. I mean, basically, the guys at South by Southwest, who've been amazingly helpful, didn't quite grasp the fact that we wanted to stream audio over the web. And so we had to do the whole thing through the little inbuilt mic on my laptop, which is why I sounded so incredibly loud and everybody else very, very quiet. Mm. Also, to add insult to injury, for some reason, Ustream freezed up and wouldn't let me log in properly to the chat room, which means we couldn't get rid of that complete arse that was in the room spamming everybody.
Rest assured that won't happen again. So don't let it put you off the live shows. We do love doing them when we can. And we hope to do some more in the near future. Thanks very much for listening, and normal service will be resumed next week.
Certainly will.
Bye-bye.
Hello, world of Boehm.
It's like being on David Letterman.
Boehm world.